We're almost at the end. I can't believe it. Seems like we just sat down. I thought I'd end this last talk here with an idea that we don't really talk a lot in Theravadin practice. It's taught more in Mahayana practice, which is the preciousness of this human birth. And that practice is much more in Mahayana practices. You spend a lot of time reflecting on the preciousness of this human birth. And I thought I'd talk a little bit about what I think that means and how I think that applies to our situations that we're in, why it's connected to the Four Noble Truths. So I want to take a step back. Something Margot said earlier this morning. She said, I don't understand why Tuareg, or she thought it was interesting that I started practicing around the same time I became a lawyer. And actually, it's connected to the fact that I failed the bar exam twice. If you think about it, lawyers, we're a bit, if you know any lawyers, we're a little on the heady side, a little bit on the self-absorbed side. And I think it's because when we're in college and high school, we're very smart. I mean, we do very well in school, and school is not a problem for us. So we get into law school, and just everything about this idea of becoming a lawyer, there's a sense that, oh, all I got to do is get out of law school, pass the bar, and I'm just clean sailing from then on out. It's all gravy, all downhill. And when I got out of law school, I failed the bar. And I had come from such a traumatic, messy world that failing the bar was just not something I ever envisioned. I never in a million years would have anyone told me that you would fail something that was just a test, because I ace tests. Fail the bar, that's like money, that's like one test. To make matters worse, I mean, failing the bar, first of all, it cost about $400 just to sit for the bar. And it takes about 6 months from the time you pay out all that money before you actually sit. And then if you fail it, you got to wait 6 more months before it comes around again, because it only comes around twice a year. So now I got to wait. I had prayed to get this particular job, and I was so happy I got it. I got it. And then I failed the bar. And I had to give up my job because it was contingent upon me passing the bar. So I'm a single mother, got to give up my job. Don't know how I'm going to pay. Probably have to get on welfare, some craziness like this. I'm just like a mess. But that's okay. That's okay. I figure, you know, I sucked it up through most of my college years with the boys. I'm just going to suck it up, take the bar a second time. Okay, a little blip on the screen, and then we're back going to the way things were. And then I took the bar the second time, and I failed a second time. And that was too much for me. I could not understand it. I couldn't grasp it. I couldn't get it. I just didn't understand. And I know some of you in this room have had that sense of, I wish I had somebody else's life, that all the mess I had grew up with, all the abuse and the trauma, that's why I failed the bar. You know, I was so disgusted with everything. Just mad at God, mad at everybody, my parents, school, everybody. And so I went to the library. Actually, I went to Barnes & Noble. That's what I called the library. I went to Barnes & Noble to find me a book, because I was going to find something else. I was going to find something. I was punishing God, and I was going to leave him. and go find something else that I could practice with that was going to be better than him. Anything would be better than him. And I found two books. One was a book on 3-minute meditation by Ben and Jerry, the ice cream people. So just 3 minutes of meditation. And one was a book called Training the Mind by Trogyam Trungpa, who's a Tibetan teacher, Pema Chodron's teacher. Little crazy guy, but still, good Dhamma. So I took those two books and I began to read them over and over and over and over and over and over and over. And at first, I had this thought that I was going to turn into a little Buddha, that I was going to turn into a Buddha and that I was going to float on through the world. Somehow or another, everything would come, anything that would happen to me, fly away. Actually, after I got that book, I decided, maybe I don't trust myself so much on the bar. I went and got hypnotized and took the bar the third time and passed it. I still think it was because I got hypnotized to pass the third time. But I have all these friends that say, no, it's because you studied so much. I don't think so. But then I started practicing law and practicing the Dhamma. Practicing. And my view was that I just need to get this technique down, and that's it. So I don't know if they had in here the TV show Kung Fu back in the 70s. Did you guys have Kung Fu? Best ever. Best ever! I loved James Carrington. And I was going to be a female James Carrington. I was going to be a female version of that guy. For those of you that are, I'm dating myself on, or you never saw it, it was this movie, this guy was back in the Wild Wild West days, and they always make the cowboys look really bad, and so these guys are all rough and tough, and he's supposed to be Asian, he's white, but we don't really know that he's white, he looks Asian to us, I don't know why, but he... He had a bald head, so he looked Asian. So anyway, they always called him a Chinaman, and they disrespected him, and they mistreated him so much. And he would recall his teachings that he got when he was in the temple in Asia. And that's how he would get through all the situations. So whatever happened to him, he would find his inner core, his inner stillness, his inner strength, and he could handle anything. No matter how bad they were outside, he was strong on the inside. And so that's what I tried to be, this strong on the inside, no matter how bad it is on the outside. And it was pretty bad on the outside. I mean, one more movie. Do you know Kung Fu Panda? If you have not seen Kung Fu Panda, you need to see that for Dhamma practice. Because it is a perfect example of what we're trying to do. You know, he wanted to be a Kung Fu master. And he's a panda, so he doesn't really have this lean body. He's like a big fat rolling person. So he's trying to be, and his father, whole nother story, is a goose. And so his father, of course, we don't know that one is a panda and one is a goose. They're both together. And his father says something that I never, ever, ever forget. His father runs a restaurant making noodle soup. And he wants his son, Po, to grow up to be a part of the restaurant. It's going to be father and son. They're going to make noodle soup. But Po really wants to be a kung fu master. He wants to be, you know, like a good fighter, warrior, kung fu master. And his father doesn't see that in him, doesn't see that for him. And so one day his father in the first episode basically says, but we are noodle folk. We are noodle folk. And I remember that. We are noodle folk, and noodle folk make noodles. That's what we're supposed to do. So every once in a while, I have to tell myself, I am trauma folk. I come from trauma, and my mind spins trauma out of anything. It doesn't really matter what happens. If the sun is outside, something traumatic is going to come from that. The mind would spin this around my world all over the place. So here I am trying to be this female replica of Kung Fu, and I can't because there's so much trauma all over the place, so much mess going on all over the place. And I remember having this sense that I should have had a better life. I should have had a different life. If I'd had a better life, a different life, it would have worked. But I can't do it in this messy life I have. That is the place where the Mahayana's practice of this human birth is so important, because we don't awaken in someone else's life. We awaken in our life. And the life we have is the life that we're supposed to have. It's the life that we're supposed to be in to awaken. There's no other life out there that you can awaken in except for the one that you have. And I didn't really get that until I went on this retreat. I never went to retreats, and I was always scared. And finally, Rodney's like, you got to go to this retreat. It was at Loon Lake with Christina Feldman in 2006. Oh, that's a beautiful place there. And mostly we don't like our lives because I'm making a long-term leap judgment here, but we don't like our lives because we're not in our body. So we don't really feel our lives. We judge our lives. We're not in it. We don't know what it feels like because every time we try to get in the body, we start panicking. And much of my anxiety came from trying to get into my body. Once we start practicing, we start trying to get in the body, We start panicking because we hate whatever's in that body. I need somebody else's body. I'll take their body. That looks good. That's the body I want. But actually, there's something past that layer of panic that we have about the body. And at this retreat, I finally decided I'm not going anywhere until I get in this body. We're not going to go anywhere. We're not going to make it through anything. I'm going to have to figure this out. And so I made this resolve that I was just going to sit. Every sit, I'm going to try to stay with the body. Whatever feelings are going on, I'm going to stay right there with it. And I started feeling a lot of unpleasantness and spent the first half of the retreat crying all the time, hating my father, hating my life. If there was something to hate, I didn't even like the food. I hated everything. Just mad, because it's such a mess, and it seemed like I was too old to be dealing with all this crap. It should have been gone by now. I should have worked it out. I'm never going to get to be a female James Carrigan at this rate. I'll be dead before I can float on water and stuff, float in the air. So reactive to everything. And then everything changed. During a meal. I don't remember when the meal was, but at some meal, I remember instead of in that spinning thinking place we all get in, I just heard clanging sounds and people moving about softly. And I just could see all of us sitting there in the restaurant, eating in this dining hall, eating quietly, everybody together. And it felt like, oh my God, we're all together. I just had a sense that all of us were interconnected. We're all very close to each other. And it didn't feel like I was sitting in a room with a whole bunch of people I didn't know. It felt like I was sitting in a room with aunties and uncles and grandmas and grandpas and kids It felt like I was sitting in a room with family, and we were all sitting here together. We didn't even have to talk. I mean, I never talked to any of these people. I didn't even know them. There's about 100 people there, and I was so connected. And so when I went into the next sit, I took that sense of connection, that sense of not being alone, that sense of somehow we were all holding each other. I took that into the next sit. And so inevitably, my father showed up in that sit, and was doing his usual grumbling and complaining and making fun of me for trying to get enlightened. And I did not have a sense of sadness. Like, it's the first time I think I had compassion. I think I didn't have compassion before because I couldn't actually connect to the suffering. Instead of actually connecting to the suffering, I was just thinking about the suffering and storytelling about the suffering, and I never really felt it. But when I actually felt the suffering, I could have compassion. Like, this is very sad, this place that I happen to be in. It's very sad what I went through as a child. And it's very sad for my father that he was so angry that he just took it out on all of his kids. But there was also a sense of, you know, I'm not like my father. He just took it out on his kids and stayed with it. He died with the same sadness his whole life he spent with it. But here I was doing something. There was this sense of joy that I had and gratitude that I was actually doing something to awaken the mind. That even, it didn't matter what I was doing something to awaken the mind. And I was not just accepting or rolling over in it. So I got this metta, this compassion, and this sense of joy that was interconnected between me and everybody. We're all just sitting here. And I don't think it was that sit. I think it was a couple of sits later. I saw this thing happen. Something happened. I saw that I would hear this story that was all negative and heavy and dark and convoluted, and then there would be this very peaceful moment of just serene calmness, and then dark and heavy, and then serene. And I wanted to know what caused the serene and what caused the dark and heavy. And I began to notice, just pay attention to what was happening. And I noticed the anxiety that I had been experiencing for at least 3 or 4 years at that point, that anxiety was dark and heavy, thinking. Not even what I thought anxiety was in the body and it was a physical sensation. It never dawned on me that anxiety was thinking. And that the serene and peacefulness was presence, that it was stillness when I realized that there really isn't anything going on. And then when I was thinking, it was like all big and dark and loud and pressure and all this craziness, and then nothing, silence, nothing's going on. And I tried to stay in that presence and realized that there's a sensation in the body that every time I felt that sensation, it would remind me of my father, and I would shoot up in the head. And I would stay in the head spinning, rather than feel this sensation, because I thought the sensation was so bad. So I spent the rest of the retreat working on holding that sensation. And it was very nice, very opening retreat. So I left, a couple weeks go by, retreat's over, I'm going about my business, walking to work, have to be at work at 7 in the morning, so I'm on my way to work, and I'm walking, very nice outside. And this thought came into my head that that was the Brahma Viharas, that that experience I had at that retreat was the Brahma Viharas. The metta, the compassion, the sympathetic joy, and my ability to stay with that uncomfortableness in that sit was equanimity. And I remember standing in the street, in the sidewalk. I didn't have any sense that I should get to moving, and all these people are trying to walk around me. I'm just standing there saying, oh my God, I missed it. I missed it. Oh my God, I missed it. I can't believe it. Standing here, just realizing I misunderstood the practice for about 10 years. It took about 10 years for that moment to happen. I'd been practicing for 10, almost 15 years. And I realized in that moment that I had missed something all the while. I had thought up until that moment it was the technique that was going to get me to this liberation. Somehow I had to learn the technique of how to meditate. That's going to do it. And I was so focused on the technique, the technique, the technique. It is not that technique. It is not that. It is metta. It is having the ability to be connected to whatever is arising. Having a friendly connection with whatever is arising. And unless we have that friendly, loving, soft connection with whatever is arising, we can't be with what's arising. We can't see the truth of it. We can't see what it is that we're supposed to be seeing, what we're trying to look at, because we don't have a soft enough connection to be with it. We don't have the ability to have the equanimity to watch it, see what it is, how it's really arising. Before that moment, I thought metta was the wimpy stuff that you do, besides, they always put metta in the sleeping sit right after lunch. That's when we do metta. Anybody's ever gone on a retreat? When is the metta sit? The loving kindness sit is at 2:00, right after lunch. We just, in our practice, we do not give metta the same level of respect that we give wisdom practice. The riding the breath and the paying attention to the breath. And we give that so much attention. So that we're all sitting here trying to chase after this elusive breath that we can hardly ever get to because there's so much other stuff that keeps getting in the way. The thinking, the sounds, the sensations in the body, all that stuff is getting in the way of me trying to find the breath. All that stuff that's getting in the way, that is where metta does its best work. Metta isn't going to do its work on the breath. It's not going to help us love the breath. It doesn't do anything for the breath. But what we don't really talk about in this practice is that without metta, we don't get to the breath. Without having a friendly connection to all of those stories that are showing up in the body and all of the sensations that they bring with them and all of the stuff that's going on, the judgment and all of that that's going on during our sit, without having metta towards that, we never relax enough to really touch into the breath. We can't touch it because we can't deal with all the other stuff in front of us. That's how we awake in our urban life. It's beginning to see that the stuff that's coming up around us, that is your practice. That is where we're supposed to be at, connect to, hold it in a friendly way. if we could hold the stuff that we see in our lives in a friendly way, we wouldn't have to sit in retreat. We could be right there with it. We could be washing the dishes like Deepama, and you could be washing the dishes, and all of a sudden there's like a moment of enlightenment. If you read the suttas and the stories during the Buddhist time, I mean, they could be a little bit like Bible stories. You have to take them with a grain of salt, but still, you read the stories. When Buddha was around, all he had to do was show up and people would be getting enlightened all. Not one or two, but 500, this whole side. Everybody on this side would like scoot over here. This whole side is all enlightened. And so I like to tell people who Buddha was talking to, because that's when Brock and Margot and I were in the CDL. There was a woman in there named Pawan. And she would tell us that, she told us one time that Buddha didn't talk to these, like the big wealthy people, the people with the money, the people with the status and all of that. They really didn't want to listen to Buddha because they were too happy with what they had. So the people that Buddha was talking to would be the people that we consider the untouchables, the Dalit people, the people who were lower caste systems than the big Brahmin caste systems. These were the working class people, the lower level people. So get this in your mind. Buddha is talking about awakening in your life, and the people he's talking to are the people that are basically carrying the drudge of the world, carrying the mess of the life. They're the ones that are like wishing they had been born in a different caste. And yet these are the people that when the suttas would say 500 people got enlightened, that's who got enlightened. These people who would otherwise have miserable lives. Their lives were at least as bad as ours, if not worse. Some of them, I'm sure, had much worse lives than we have. But still, these are the people that were getting enlightened. These people whose lives were a mess. And they weren't getting enlightened and then going out into the world, and now I don't have to watch my shadow around other people. You still got to watch your shadow around other people. So you are now enlightened, and you still are a Dalit living in a caste system where you cannot let your shadow fall upon anybody else. So think about that. What would it take to be able to live in that kind of world and be enlightened? When we think of being enlightened, we think of it as, oh, it's all happy now, everything is good. But enlightenment has got to be pointed towards how we hold things, how we hold whatever it is we have to live with. It can't be about what the outer conditions of our world looks like. And there's something to be said that the people who were showing up to hear the Buddha were not the Brahmins, not the people with money, status, everything going their way. The people that were showing up were the people that were having messed up, jacked up lives. And they were the ones getting enlightened. And it's because that's where you're going to awaken, not in the good stuff. You're going to awaken when you begin to have an appreciation and respect, a friendliness, a softer connection to the bad stuff, to the stuff we think we wish we had somebody else's life and not that mess. So basically, I mean, I think that's where I'm going to leave it here. This whole time we've spent together, protect this practice that we have here. It's very special. We have a tendency to get so happy with it, we go out and say, I'm going to tell everybody. I'm going to tell all my friends. You guys got to try this. But this really isn't for them. This this practice, this day, this part right here, this for you. That's it, not for anybody else. So we have to hold it very sacred and very dear and very precious. Because as soon as you try to go explain it, that would be like me trying to explain this to my family. So like my sister, first of all, she and I don't get along very well. We're like not even a year apart. That's probably why. I think I should have been treated with the same degree of respect she was treated. But just because she was born first, she got all the accolades because she was the oldest. She got to be in charge all the time. So whenever we get together, just so you know how difficult and how foolish our arguments are, we had an argument one time because her daughter wanted to put salt on her food, and I think her daughter should have the right to choose whether to put salt on it, and her mother thought that she ate too much salt, so she should not be putting salt on her food. There was plenty salt on the food. So, of course, we had 45 minutes of yelling at each other about whether or not her daughter should have salt. That's how bad we are. So when I would go on retreat, my sister, in her great kindness, would say, we're going to have a dinner for Tuareg when she comes out, because she hasn't talked to anybody, and we're going to have food. It's going to be, I mean, usually if you go on a retreat, it's vegetarian. I'm not vegetarian, so we're going to have meat. And so all this great stuff we're going to give to her. And I would drive from Cloud Mountain to my sister's house, and I'd say within 25, 30 minutes of being there, I'm back to screaming at her. And whatever I got at Cloud Mountain was gone. And I couldn't understand. She would always look at me like, maybe you should practice more at your retreats, do longer retreats, because it's not really working. But eventually I realized what was really happening was I was not giving my practice the level of respect. I stopped doing the dinners. You are silent, you're still, you're practicing. I started giving that practice some respect and say, no, we'll wait a week. Give myself some time to be with my own practice and have a sense of care about it. So protect this. The other thing you're doing is your practice protects the mind. And so we want to take some care and protection around the mind so that the mind, it's a little apprehensive, this scary place that we go into, this uncertainty, unknown. Heart is very clear. Let's go. Let's do it. But the mind is a little nervous about it. And so we're going to give the mind a little time, a little care, like you would a child, and not just push it off into something. You know how kids are. If you say, look, show them what you can do. Show them. They won't do it at all. They will act like they don't know what you're talking about. That's sort of the way the mind is. If you push it out there and try to convince people that, look what it's done for me, it won't work so well. So just keep some care around it and protect it. And then protect your heart and your body and your spirit. It's not easy to do this practice because what we're really doing is going into the difficult. And so we need to have a humor. I always bring humor because we have to have a bit of humor about it, but we also have to have a bit of softness around it because it takes some care to do what we're asking ourselves to do, which is to go into the difficult. And then everything you see in your life, I don't care what it is, that is supposed to be there for practice. It may mean you have to make some hard choices, and it may mean that you have to do some things that you didn't want to do, but it's still there on purpose for practice. It's not some happenstance accident that you're there in that moment in life. So I think I'm going to leave it right there.